Spring Hebrew Colloquium Series. Here we are on February 8th in the midst of the blizzard of 1994. I want to introduce Tom Taylor, who has a great specialty background for his subject tonight. He's a professor of church history here at Biblical. Spent 20-some years teaching church history. And he spent at least twice that long, probably three times that long, fishing. So certainly well prepared to talk to us this evening with Sir Isaac Walton, busy apostle of the quiet spirit. Let me plug him in here and we'll be ready to go. Let's see, let me try. Let's move it backwards.
Plug it on there.
Yeah. I'm going to hang this up on you, so.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Newman. Thank you very much. I haven't spent that much time fishing. The truth of the matter is I've thought about it a lot more and I've done it. And I've spent less almost every year since I got married than I did any year before I was married. But I've always enjoyed it. I'm not really an angler. I'm just a guy that goes out and catches a few fish and brings them home and eats them from time to time. And I was attracted to this subject for a brief. Isaac Walton, the busy apostle of quiet spirit. It's kind of a grandiose title for a thing. I said to myself, well, how do you put a thing like this into the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute? The concept is that Walton was, first of all, a very committed Christian. And secondly, he was committed to the enjoyment of nature and the creation of God, and to finding in that a solace and a rest for himself that a lot of times we don't find. Sometimes in the, particularly the technological age in which we live, we get wrapped up with things enormously and miss some of the great things that God has created and given us. Now, Walton was one of those men who lived in a really difficult age. I'll mention it in a couple of moments, I think. But a really difficult age with lots of complexities, but he found that what the soul needed was not just a solution to more problems and more mathematics, but what the soul needed was an opportunity from time to time to grip the reality of the presence of God in his universe and to enjoy that particular thing. He certainly thought you could do it at fishing, and he thought that because, among other things, the Lord chose fishermen to work for him, and fish were created before man was created, and a lot of other things. Some of it biblical, the exegesis would scare you a little bit, and others you'd be kind of happy with. It depends. But he really thought that that was it. There were other things, too. He had nothing against certain other things if you wanted to do them. But fishing, he said, gave you the maximal opportunity to relax and enjoy the creation of God in a practical way. He also knew that not everybody would do it. So I thought that maybe in an Ibri colloquium and the things that go along, might be good to have some contemplative, relaxing aspects of life that allows us to function kind of as people, not as machines. And for those people who get bored and can't do anything at fishing, then they can read books, or they can go out and pound nails. They can do whatever maximizes their energies and strengths and gives them freedom from the pressures that hit us day by day. But Walton, as a very committed Christian, as a capable businessman, really went out of his way to stress the importance of a contemplative life, not in a monastery, but in the good and the enjoyment of the nature that God had put about us. I have on this little sheet of paper I've passed out, I have five or six steps to discuss his life. They could probably be better organized. Lots of other things could be better organized. The truth is, his life is so fragmentarily known that it's hard to believe. But I have, and I'll just stick with my outline so that everybody will kind of know where I am. When I get there, you'll know where I am. When I'm past there, you'll know that I'm gone. But I break it down into two or three concepts. And the first concept is a study of Newton, of Walton's life. Incidentally, the spelling Isaac, I-Z-A-A-K, was probably the result of semi-literate parents. That's probably the result. It's hard to know. Now, Walton lived from 1593 to 1683. He was 90 years old and 5 months when he died. He was in his 91st year. We do not know almost anything about his first few years. We know that his father ran an alehouse, and that he died soon after Isaac was born. His mother, enjoying life married to alehouse keepers, married another alehouse man, and so he was raised under the influence of people who had an alehouse. We don't know if it was a good place or bad place today. You've got to remember that in England of those days, an alehouse was just like a restaurant, kind of like a McDonald's with suds on the sign or something like that. But whatever the case happens to be, we know nothing of his education. I could say that out of the first 20 years of his life, so little is known that it hardly makes any kind of a decent biographical memoir at all. I picked up a volume of The Complete Angler, the edition put together in the classic book series, and the author writing in the foreword of that He says, as far as his early life is concerned, he said, we might just as well forget it. We can speculate all we want. I mentioned just a few things with regard to it. I mentioned in particular that he had a professional career, but we don't know a lot about it. We do know a lot about the age in which he lived. It was a great literary age. It was an age of enormous superstition. You know, even James I of England wrote a book against witches before he became King of England while he was in Scotland. An age of enormous superstition. That superstition period is pretty well tracked out by Trevor Roper, and it continues from about 1580 to right around the middle of the 17th century. And likewise, it was the time of the rebellion in England when the commoners turned out the Parliament and when Charles I was beheaded and there were lots of upheavals. We know that about the age. Walton lived through that sort of a troubled sort of time, so it wasn't what you call an idyllic period where everybody sat under his fig tree and his grapevine. It was a time of stress and difficulty. We know that in his professional career that around 1611 he was apprenticed to a man named Thomas Grinsell. You don't have to write that down. It's really not known. Thomas Grinsell, who was a relative too. Grinsell was an ironmonger, a man who, like today you'd say a hardware store person, something along that sort. He didn't run a foundry. He sold hard goods. There's a great tradition that Isaac Walton had a clothier business and had a linen draper shop in Fleet Street. He certainly had a shop in Fleet Street, but his license commercially was that of an ironmonger. And so we don't really know if he ever sold any linens or not. Maybe the clothes were tougher in those days, too. We do know in 1614 he owned a small place, or used a small place, half of a shop for 4 years in Fleet Street, selling hardware materials, presumably. And 1618 was released from the ironmonger's work, and after that we know palpably little of how he made his money and the things that happened to him. What we do know is that he acquired considerable property over life, was quite wealthy, quite generous, useful with what he had, and he seemed to enjoy the ability to make it or to get it, whether the commoners were in control or the royalists were in control, although Walton himself was really a royalist of a very strong, strong sort. Commercially, I guess we'll say he was a shopmaster in the years that followed that, and we'll just let it stand at that. After 1624, he becomes increasingly active in St. Dunstan's Church in the territory in which he lived, and he will be marked in London, that is, St. Dunstan's in London, and he'll be marked for some time as a man of considerable religious activity. And I mention his two marriages to, I think, again, you don't, the names are printed here, to Rachel Flood. She was a grand niece to Thomas Cranmer. That's really stretching it a little bit, but that's what she was. And many authors who originally talked about Walton thought that probably he was brought into a literary circle through his marriage to Rachel Flood. We don't know. He often speaks disparagingly of his own education, but with his own education, disparagingly or not, he became wise enough to read and converse freely in Italian and French and to read Latin well and to do other things. So somewhere along the line he got with people that could move him educationally. She died in 1640 after 7 children were born, all of whom died in infancy. And in 1646, have to watch, I sometimes get in the wrong century, folks. In 1646, he married Anna Ken, half-sister to Bishop Thomas Ken, the famous hymn writer. She lived until 1662, and they had a son, Isaac, and a daughter, Anne. They were wise enough to spell Isaac in a more, like you'd spell it. And, of course, Anne, anybody can spell that. Both Isaac and Anne lived in maturity and had long lives. And it was in Anne's home that Isaac Walton spent his last few years, and he eventually died there. I mentioned his spiritual experience. He was profoundly Anglican. I know that what church he belonged to doesn't make a great deal of difference, but he was profoundly Anglican. And every now and then in the complete anger of the book that I look at in greatest detail, every now and then you'll find a little way to dig in some Anglican ideals, like a long poem he quotes on the advantage of having printed prayers as opposed to prayers that people make up if they don't know whether they're coming or going, and a few little things like that. But after 1624 in particular, he shows up at St. Dunstan's in London, and in the next 20 years held just about every non-clergy office that you can hold in the church. By non-clergy, I mean the warden, the guys like that, the fellow that passes out the hymn books, and the man who counts the money, and that sort of thing. He held just about every office. His name shows in the records very much of the time. And during that period, he became familiar with John Donne, the English poet and bishop at St. Dunstan's in those years, John Donne. After 1630, he was enormously close to Donne. and done thought the world of Walton. Walton, you'll discover, has the ability to make friends and to have them years and years later, even if they move into different political realms. His piety is a kind of funny sort of thing. It's hard for me to just know how you say a man is pious, because we often use that in a strange way. Probably the best way to speak of his piety is to read the biographies he wrote and see the things he stresses as being valuable in life, and to read The Complete Angler and see how he works scripture ideas into almost everything from putting a needle to a hook in a worm to carrying fish home and cooking it. I'm sure that he had rough edges too. And if you judge him on today's standards, it would be pretty tough. You have to remember there were not many teetotalers in this time at all. And so at the end of a day's fishing, Walton likes to sit down with his friends and have a nice tank of ale and something to stimulate the soul like that. You better remember that that's the way people lived at that time. You remember that when Squanto was brought to Miles Standish, his first word to Miles Standish was, "Do you have any beer?" Because he'd lived, you know, so long in England. "Do you have any beer?" And Miles Standish did not look at him and say, "We're Puritans, we don't drink beer." Miles Standish said, "We drank it all in the winter on the boat." He said, words to that effect. He said, "We do have a little brandy." And Squanto said, "Oh, that would be good. Brandy would do just as well." Those aren't the exact words, of course, but that's the general narration of that thing. His political movements, he was a royalist in a very, very powerful sort of way. And as a royalist, he upheld the rights of the king. He felt terrible when Parliament revolted against the king. And for a few years, he moved away from London. But the ironic thing is, it's hard to say it just right. The ironic thing is that he always seems to enjoy the general good feelings of people on both sides. And he looked at the royalist movement as some kind of a heaven sent from God sort of thing, the divine right of kings almost. And he looked at the people of Parliament, Presbyterians, Baptists, Independents, as schismatics, and he didn't have a lot of use for schismatics, although he's careful what he says about them. He gives a poem in The Complete Angler, which plays against the background of the schismatics. It was written by a man named Frank Davison sometime before, and it kind of goes like this. Now, I won't sing it. I'll just kind of read it. I'm not notably a good poetry reader. It's a group of beggars. They just had a great time. They're begging. They're begging. They don't have any of the good stuff, but they're begging. And the parody is on the particular people whom he calls schismatics. "Bright shines the sun. Play, beggars, play. Here's scraps enough to serve today. What noise of vials is so sweet as when our merry clappers ring? What mirth doth want when beggars meet? A beggar's life is for a king. Eat, drink, and play. Sleep while we list. Go where we will, so stocks be missed. Bright shines the sun. Play, beggars, play. Here's scraps enough to serve today." Now, it's not a political treatise. It's a book on fishing. But in the thrust of it, he just starts and says, all right, it's like the schismatic, some of these poor fish are. He said, they're happy with a meal of scraps, so they just have to let them go that way. Let them sing them songs and enjoy themselves. So when I say he's conciliatory, I'm not sure that, that he runs around giving out papers on how to compromise. But the idea is that while he stood pretty firmly, he did it in a way that he was rather trusted and eventually loved by the great multitude of people. Of his hobby, fishing, he said, "I don't envy the man who has more money than I. I don't envy the man who has more property than I," etc., etc. He goes, Walton, like many of the men of his day, goes through about 10 things in every point. But eventually, he says, "I envy only the man who catches more fish than I do." When Walton died, it was 1683, the 15th of December, at his daughter's home, at Anne's home, in Winchester. He was living at that time with her. He lived back and forth from two or three leading nobility in the English clergy, but his daughter Anne provided him with a really nice home in his old age, and he loved her, loved the things that went on, the happiness and all of that sort of thing. Just a few days before he died, he wrote his will. He thought he was going to die, so he wrote his will, and he passed away, and he's buried at Winchester Cathedral. I haven't been there. You'll be glad to know. But he's buried at Winchester Cathedral, and there's a stained glass picture. He's in the North Annex section. Stained glass picture there of Walton standing in the brook with his rod and with his line. Seemed like a strange picture for a church, but it characterized his life. And the epitaph that's on his grave reads like this. "Alas, he's gone before, gone to return no more. Our panting breasts aspire after their aged sire, whose well-spent life did last full 90 years and past. But now he hath begun that which will ne'er be done, crowned with eternal bliss, we wish our souls also with." Kind of a striking sort of thing for Walton. I mentioned then his work just a little bit. His work, I mentioned earlier that he served in just about every capacity he could in the church except a clerical capacity. But while he was doing those things and making a living at different businesses that we don't know much about, he's referred to often as a gentleman in the English language. You know, a gentleman is somebody that doesn't work a lot but has enough money to live like he worked a lot. He certainly didn't inherit it, so it came along in natural means, I think. But he developed an interest in biography. I don't know how to say it exactly, but not so much, you know, he was sitting around saying, what can I write up? But he was interested in people. Walton was always a center of a circle of friends, of an evangelical mind and of many other good things, too. So he was going to prepare some of the letters of John Donne. John Donne was an English poet who had a wild youth and then was converted and became one of the outstanding clergymen of that particular period. But he was going to edit the letters of John Donne, and he kind of felt in editing the letters of John Donne that he would put a little biography of Donne at the start of it. And so Walton's biographies are never big bombs. It's a kind of a short biography. I've had access to it a couple of times. Of it, Johnson, the English critic, said years ago, he said it was the finest biography that he ever read. Now, a lot of water has flown under the bridge since then. But Walton had a sense of capturing the essence of what people were in the biography. He did it very much by concentrating on his personal contacts, his interviews, his understandings, and an emphasis on the things he thought they did well, rather on the things that he thought they failed in. Now, Walton at times approaches hero worship, maybe not in a really full-blown sense, but at times he's very much in that general direction. If he likes almost everybody except a few schismatics, and even those he can tolerate. And if they wet a line and go out for the carp or the trout, he can tolerate them rather well. But whatever the case is, he wrote The Life of John Donne in 1640 as a prelude to his work. Henry Wotton, whom I mentioned on my notes, was a prominent English politician, served as an ambassador to Spain and Italy and various other places, and also a godly man. Wotton put together his memorial details in 1651 and once again wrote a little life to go in the start of. Richard Hooker was a cleric of those days, along with George Herbert, whose name is really quite well known to us in religious and theological sources. I mentioned the dates of these things. You know, you can live and not know the dates. But that he did those four, and then those four were issued as a separate publication by a lot of different people. They're, the four of them together just make still a rather smallish book. But he had the ability to crisply state what was important in a man's life. And the result is that Professor Goss, the English literary giant of the last century, noted that the age of modern biography began with Walton, the age where you didn't have a panegyric, but where you took a few simple and direct statements about a man, his life, and his influence, and put them together. I won't work on those, I don't think, in any greater detail. I will say that he was never satisfied with the thing, so he revised everything. Walton was revising up till his 86th year, works that he had written. He just didn't wait to publish it. He published, but then he'd say, well, this, and so he was constantly revising. I was in the Schuylkill Book and Curio Shop about, how long has Biblical been here? About 22 years ago. First year Biblical was here. I went over to the Schuylkill Book and Curio Shop, thought we might be able to get some books for our library, which at that time had about 20. My fellow at the Schuylkill Book and Curio Shop would have sold us thousands, but he knew the very best price for everything, and he was asking it. I think he thought that we were in a situation, oh, never mind, but we didn't get any from him anyway. But I spent a day listening to him. He was really worth listening to. He had been for several years the president of the Ancient Book Society in the United States and a curator of two or three things. He was worth listening to. If you don't mind somebody constantly telling you how dumb you are and how intelligent he is, he was worth listening to. And so he took me over to the safe. It took me and whoever from Biblical was with me that day. He took us over to the safe. He says, I want to show you men something. He said, I want to show you something. And he brought out a card file. And he said, I'm evaluating this card file of books, he said. Now, the books are in a vault in the bank. But he said, I'm evaluating the card file. He said, you know, in this card file, he said, in this book, he said, is a card for every edition of The Complete Angler, Walton's big angling work. He said there have been more than 300 editions of it by all sorts of different people. And he said this man who had his collection had at least one volume from each one, including the second edition, which he said is so rare that it's almost priceless. He said, you can hardly believe it. He said, I'm going to give them an estimate and they'll know how much, you know, to pay for all that sort of stuff. Well, I didn't really think much about that because I had read some of those works by Walton earlier in life, but I wasn't terribly impressed. When you're 16 years old, and somebody keeps spelling fly, F-L-I-E-I, it bugs you just a little bit, you know. In the old orthography school we were raised in, every word could be spelled and had to be spelled just right. You didn't spell photograph, F-O-T-O-G-R-A-F. I'm a pain of death. You didn't do it. But in Walton's day, when orthography was not so set, they spelled words the way they thought they sounded. And sometimes they didn't sound like what they were. In the notes to this work on the world's classics on Walton, in the end notes to it, he notes two or three words, which he says, we have no idea what these words were. Maybe it was this, maybe it was this, because Walton spelled a word, etc. Well, that's the way it goes, I think. But he revised completely and never really gave it up. Now, I mentioned the great work, The Complete Angler, which is not a biblical work, but if you got the fifth edition and begin reading it, you'll think that it is. And the Complete Angler. The Complete Angler is an interesting sort of work. Walton had several of the fishing books that were prominent in his day. Writing fishing books didn't start with Walton. It's hard to know when the first one started. One of the very finest old-time fly books was written by a Catholic nun back in the 1490s or 1480s, well before Walton. But what he did was to write a book that talked about the fishing concept as the contemplative purge for the difficulties and struggles of the soul. That's what he worked at. And so The Complete Angler was first written and first published in 1653. You'll note that Walton, by that time, is 60 years old. Most of his writings come in the latter half of his life, but 60 years old. The final edition, which was the fifth one, came in 1676, and he added to it work by a couple of other men in one or two editions. But The Complete Angler is the account of Walton going fishing. He doesn't call himself Walton. He rarely refers to himself. In his own biographical things, he always just says I-Z-W-A, Izwa. This is a short form of writing Isaac Walton. But in this particular account, he's headed out, and he's headed out with, by himself, really. But as he comes to Tottenham Hill, he spots some men ahead of him, and he lunges forward to catch up to them. There being no buses, these men are walking. He lunges to catch up to them to find where they're going because he said if they can go together, good company shortens a journey. And that was his philosophy. One of those men is a hawker. Alkeps is his name. In the book, the pseudonym, Alkeps, for the use of hawks. And one of them is a hunter, Venator, later sometimes called Viator. Venator, he's the hunter. And Walton, of course, dubs himself Piscator because he's the fisherman. They should have had a Toreador, but you have to do without some things in the course of life. So they are walking along, and each one tells what he likes best about his sport. And after Walton tells what he likes best about fishing, Venator thinks he'd like to learn more about fishing, too. So they spend a day hunting. They're hunting river otters. Walton will invest a day hunting river otters because he hates them. They eat too many fish. It's one of the few things in the universe he wishes that weren't. I kind of chuckled at it, you know, when you're talking about being nice to everything, and he says, I hate all the river otters. And when the dogs finally catch one, he said, may they tear it to pieces. And when someone says, we found their pups, Walton said, kill all their pups. But Buddy says, save one for me. I'll try to make a pet out of it. I was kind of struck by that in the course of things. But he goes hunting with Venator for a day, and then he will take Venator fishing for a few days. I can't go over the whole book because that becomes a painful sort of process. But the rest of the book is an account of fish and fish baits and how you fish for them, all in this friendly, conversational sort of way, in which Walton will often say, I marvel at your ears are still, you can still hear, you know, after all this discussion. And Venator would say, oh, tell me more. I think he must have written those lines, too. But it's just a remarkable sort of thing, friendly, honest conversation. Its English is harder to read than the King James. So it needs some patience when you're reading the English. And if there's a modern version of it, I haven't seen it. Maybe it would lose its charm. I don't know. But it goes along that line. On the second day, after a night at the inn, now I must tell you, I hate to drag these things out, but you know, they go to an inn and spend the night, and Venator is Venator's favorite. He's the hunter, Venator. It's his favorite inn. And the next day they're leaving, and Walton, and he says to Walton, he says, how'd you like the host? Wasn't the host a happy and jolly sort? And Piscator, or Walton, says, yes, he said, but did you notice his humor was mostly vulgar and profane and contrary to God's laws, he says. He said, I really don't enjoy that sort of thing. Tonight, he said, we'll go to the inn where I like to go for fishing trips, and you'll see a real hostess who works on good principles and so forth and so forth. And I've noted that since I both hunt and fish, I've noted kind of happily, you can't make great generalities. But in hunting, you meet You always reach a rougher crowd in hunting. Once in a while, you'll meet some really soft ones, too. But you meet men in hunting, they're used to shooting stuff. But in fishing, you tend to meet guys who sooner sit around, tell a story, and go out and do other things, as a rule. So they actually go fishing after the second day, and they'll fish for 2 or 3 days. And the fishing will proceed by going down the stream, and Walton will tell Venator how to hold his rod, and how to put the bait in the water. He'll show him how to catch one kind of fish and one kind of another fish. He'll show him that when the weather turns foul and it begins to rain, you don't curse yourself over it. You go find a sycamore tree or a willow tree and sit down under it for shelter from the rain. I don't know much about the trees of England. Now, the sycamore is the European plane. I know something about that. And the great thing about these trees, I don't know if Walton knew this or not, but the great thing about these trees is because of their crown effect, they're almost never hit by lightning. You're almost lightning safe under a willow. Don't try it next week, but you're almost lightning safe under a willow or under sycamore because of the crown shape and compactness of them. Oh, I don't know if Walton knew anything about that or not, but he says, don't get angry. Go and sit down under the dense shelter of this tree, and there they would think about fishing. And he would lecture on the different kinds of baits and how to tie the different kind of flies. Then when the weather broke, incidentally, when it was raining like that, they left their baits in the water. They're working now not with flies, but with live baits, worms. So Walton would fish with anything, just about. So he would say to Venator, he'd say, why trouble ourselves with our rods? We can see them from under the shelter of the tree. And then when it's over, like I used to fish for catfish, they go over and pick up the rod, and a fish would be on it. Venator is so surprised when a fish has taken his bait that he gives him a vicious yank and pulls the hook out of his mouth. And the fish is gone. And Walton says, if you'd had a little more patience, you know, just a little more patience. And the man says, well, will the fish suffer from this? No, Walton says, he'll be as good as new. Just in any words to that effect. You understand, I don't quote those things exactly. Well, after you find the weather and you learn how to fish, then you take and eat the fish. And the complete angler is full of menus for fish. I was going to read the menu for preparing carp, but I gave that up. I don't think carp is good under any circumstance, Walton or not. But he's big on recipes. And when you get to the inn and hand your fish to the hostess, if she doesn't know how you want it cooked, you tell her so. And she will cook it and bring it out with a couple crocks of ale. On this fishing trip, Walton meets his brother and another man with them. So they're able to sit around and eat at the table at night and have a tank of ale and then to tell happy stories with their friends. You know, it's one of those things that's kind of a lost art for us. Of course, I'm a big talker. I don't mean a good one, but a big talker. When you're a big talker, you naturally tell a lot of stories. But I like to listen to stories, too. And in the case of the refined moments of life, the sitting about with one another and just sharing little pleasant things. They could be spiritual, what God has done. They could be practical, the fish you missed. But sharing little practical things is really a great blessing. I have, for the last several years, gone fishing with President Dunbar and his father and sons. And a few years ago, went with his grandfather. They have a big boat. But whatever the case is, they've been good enough to take me fishing with them, and I've appreciated it very much. But you know, the fishing is great, and we always catch a lot of fish. But somehow the morning break when we come in and eat donuts together is one of those times you remember later on in the summer. And in the evening, after you've finished, you've cleaned the fish, and you've had a big meal, you kind of sit around in kind of ratty-like chairs in the fishing cabin with the odor of old mold on all sides and talk about the adventures of life. It is a great sort of situation. People that are overly productive cannot stand it hardly. They have to be doing something, and once in a while it's tough on me because I'm prone to be productive, but it's a great moment. You can just kind of let the mind pass. Well, these men would meet, and then they would sing a few songs. Here's the angler song. In this particular book, it's printed along with words and music, but I will not sing it. It's written, of course, in the music of its day, in which there are only two parts, the cantus and the bassus. They were slowly developing these other things. And here's the nature of it. I'm not going to sing it. Don't look worried. But here's the nature of it. Well, where are my glasses? Man's life is but vain, for it is subject to pain and sorrow and short as a bubble. It is a hodgepodge of business and money and care and money and trouble. But we'll take no care when the weather proves fair, nor will we vex now though it rain. We'll banish all sorrow and sing till tomorrow, and angle again. There are several stanzas. I'll not read them. The tune, and my wife and I have worked with the piano, the tune kind of goes like this. Ta 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 ta, and short as a bubble, like that. But I won't trouble you even beyond that. It goes to several lines and several stanzas. There are a number of angler songs that go with this particular work. I wanted to read a couple of them later, but sometimes you're better to do it when you do it. Walton has a long one, which probably was written by himself. It's hard to know exactly. He wrote some things under pen names and other things like that. He talks about the angler's saw and how angling is all you really want to do. And how, for recreation. You've got to have a productive life with Walton. You're not just a bum who fishes all the time. Of recreation, there's none so free as fishing is alone and so forth. He's not pleading that the man just forsake his family and go fishing. If you don't have your business and household affairs, you're not a gentleman, not really able to enjoy what God has provided. Well, I just mentioned the songs in general sense. The fishing trip is built up of those things. The character of the advice is given is a very interesting sort of thing. He tells how to make a rod. Now, you could go and buy them. No problem there. You could go and buy a rod. There are a lot of other things you could buy, too, but he tells how to make a rod and how to work with it and how to use it in several ways. He tells how to make a line. You could go and buy a line, but Walton rather preferred it if you made your own. My, of course, today we have nylon and monofilament lines. I can already imagine when I was a boy, we had silk lines. Silk lines, of course, were somebody else made them too. But if you cut them off, you could split them, and you could see there were always 6 or 8 fibers in them, depending on the weight of line that you wanted. A very, very fine trout line, when I was a boy, might only have 4 fibers, and you were supposed to be careful with it. But in Walton's day, they didn't have fishing reels. They were not yet really invented. So Walton urged a stout, well-made hair line so that you could get the fish with as little nonsense as possible. You had to be careful not to, pull the hook out or hurt the fish, but get him out of the water, get him on the bank. He's a big fish, get the net. They did have nets. But today we have reels, and you reel up the line, and we go out with 100 yards of line. I don't know what Walton would have thought about that. He thought if you had 20 yards, you're lucky indeed. You had to be careful how you laid it out. I shan't go into those things, but he tells the Venator how to make all that stuff, tells him how to make dozens of different kinds of flies. And some of those flies are known to us today, and the description in my fly-tying book is hardly a bit different from Walton's day. Except we have a jig and a vise, and we use silk thread rather than a couple of other things to tie them. I don't tie them. I buy flies. I'm very clumsy. When you're very clumsy, you wind up with a fly tied to your thumb, and you're not sure how to cast it or something like that. But I have friends who tie beautiful ones. He also discusses how you prepare it, and he discusses the fish bait and other subjects. And Walton wants you to have a lot of fish bait along, because if you're not complete in all those things, well, you can hardly stand to go out if you're not complete. So here's the fisherman going out. Here's his little song about the fisherman going out with his tackle box. My rod and my line, my float and my lead, my hook and my plummet, my whetstone and knife, my basket, my baits, both living and dead, my net and my meat, for that is the chief. Then I must have thread, hairs green and small, with mine angling purse, and so you have all. I used to marvel at guys who go with a tackle box that's almost the size of a great barrel and fish with one little thing all day. But says Walton, if you've got the tackle, you'll be able to get the fish. Now, he admits that once in a while there'll be a day when you won't, but generally it's because you don't have the tackle or you're fishing for the wrong fish at the wrong time or at the wrong place. His ultimate advice is to know and enjoy the Lord and his creation, and let other things like money, property, and reputation take a secondary place to a quiet heart and a happy spirit. That's how he ends the complete angler. He ends it, they've gone through all these things with he and Venator and Piscator. They've covered more ground. They've touched on the lakes, the rivers in England, and the lakes, and where you can go. He's talked on the things that you do legally in fishing and the things that you shouldn't do. Be careful about trespassing, he says, and things like that. He goes through many things along those lines. And then he comes to Venator and he says, I want to just tell you, they're almost at Tottenham Court back in London, and he says, I want to tell you just a few things. I won't read all of those things, but anyone who's interested in them, in the complete Walter, the complete angler, it's the very last section. The very last section before he himself is done. Have a couple long poems in it and other things like that. He says, I want you to know that you can have money and you can have all sorts of things, but if you do not have peace and you don't have an understanding of God's truth, you don't really have anything. That's the subsistence of it in a general sense. When I beget content and increase confidence in the power and wisdom and providence of Almighty God, I will walk the meadows with some gliding stream. There contemplate the lilies that take no care, and those many other various little living creatures that are not only created by fed, man knows not how, by the goodness of God, and therefore trust in him. This is my purpose, so let everything that hath breath praise the Lord, and let the blessings of St. Peter's Master be with mine. That's beautiful, Venator says, and consequently, that's the pronouncement of Venator to Walden's advice. And Piscator then says, and upon all lovers of venture be this providence. And he closes the account with 1 Thessalonians 4:11, study to be quiet. Study to be quiet. Just an interesting sort of thing. Unhappily, when you're talking about books, you have a tendency to ramble about stuff that doesn't really do a lot of good. But Professor Goss, writing in 1896 about, and said that the Complete Angler, he said, undoubtedly was the best written technical treatise in the English language. Well, if you're not a fisherman, it might not impress you very much. But when you consider that he covers all the known fish in England, all sorts of baits that are used, and dozens of other things, and he does it in a book of about 200 pages, so it's a reasonable size printing, it's amazing what he does, along with all the poems, songs, and other things. On his character, I mark two or three things. He's marked by industriousness, courtesy, and dependability. Walton was dependable as much as a human being could be it. And in the days of the rebellion, one of the great English jewels that Charles had tried to smuggle out of England, and then he had been caught, you know, and was later executed for his attempting to bring a French army in. But the jewels were hidden in different places, and somebody came on the second largest of all the royal jewels, wondered how to get back to London in the way that the commoners would not pounce on it and sell it to Pope or somebody. And it was handed to Walton to bring back to England. It took him about 5 years, I think, but handed to Walton to bring back to England. They said, trustworthy, honest Isaac Walton will keep it well. And in due turn, he returned it to London so it could be reestablished with the king's jewels. That's a kind of a high-level dependability, I think. Noted for a happy disposition, a love of literature, easy temperament. I think if you don't have that, it's hard to get it. You kind of have to be born with that. But easy temperament, appreciation of others, retention of friends. Walton has a wide circle of friends. And until you get 200 years later, you hardly read anybody saying a nasty thing about him. You come on some guys later, naturally, who wonder about this and that. His great friend was Charles Cotton, among other things. I haven't mentioned Cotton in the pages, I don't think. Cotton was kind of a wild cavalier. The author of one of the books I read said that for Cotton to be in Isaac Walton's circle of friends was like a saber-flinging cowboy in the midst of a Quaker meeting, he said. But Walton exercised great influence on Cotton. He wrote a lot of religious poetry later and a lot of other things. And he asked for Walton in his old age, he said, could he please call him his father? And Walton said, certainly. He said, you can call me father and I'll be pleased to call you son. Well, Cotton was well-to-do. And like any well-to-do son would do, built a fishing cottage right out on piles in the middle of one of the prime fishing rivers near his estate. And Walton would occasionally resort to that place. He could sit in the porch in his old age, you know, in the older 80s, he could sit in the porch and fish in the stream right from Cotton's cottage. So I only mentioned that. The circle of friends was a very beautiful one. Yeah, they like to fish, but they like to do a lot of other things, too. Well, I've already read a few poems. I have a section here that says a few poems. I think that you don't need many more poems from me in this connection, but the Complete Angler is full of them, because he thinks of wisdom that some poet said, maybe an old Greek poet, maybe some modern English poet. And when I read through those and read the names of people, I wonder if they made them up or if they were real people. But the man who edited the Angler in the World's Classics leaves full notes on a lot of them. Once in a while, he'll say of someone, I can find no record of it. And somebody else he'll say, I can find a record, I'm not sure how Walton knew about it. And of others, he gives us full data on the background of them. But the circumstances were that he was widely read and reported in that. You'll be struck sometimes by the gullibility and credulity of Walton at strange things, which today we know are just not so at all, like the eels. He suspects that a lot of the eels are born by a spontaneous generation out of the muck of the swamps. And he thinks there may be some frogs born like that, too, because he has a book by Professor Gessner from Switzerland who talks about the production of frogs along those lines. Today, scientifically, I'm not a great scientist by any means, but we know that nothing is conceived just by muck laying together. This is before Darwin, of course. We know that nothing was started that way. But you have to realize that the eels were a conundrum to the scientific community for centuries, because, of course, the eels all breed out in the Sargassum Sea,
which is a long way out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And then they return to the countries from which they came. It's hard. Now, you can't go out there and tag a little eel, but eels from Denmark and the Netherlands and England and various other European countries, as well as eels from the eastern United States, have gone through this tagging process where the government puts a ring in their tails, which the more recent ones are rings that can't be seen, that can be read with a scanner or an infrared or something like that. So they'll scoop up 400 or 500 eels, and here they'll find eels that have been to this country and out and bred and back and so forth and so forth. But they've pretty well established that the eels that go from Denmark and breed out in the sea, their little eels from them come back to Denmark. They've pretty well established that. But the breeding of eels was really just a conundrum in the scientific world. You know, you could watch them in your pond for the rest of your life. Next thing you know, there'd be 5 or 6 little eels there, and you hardly realize that they'd swum in from the ocean. You could hardly believe it. He's also struck by how the trout and the salmon can climb the waterfalls. He relates seeing a salmon jump over a ledge of rock in a creek 8 feet high. That's probably true. I've seen things close to that myself, hurling themselves up in the air, bending themselves and so forth. But you'll discover that he's gullible in lots of things, particularly if he thinks the guy who says it is somebody that has really been exposed to it. And so I mentioned the epitaph at his Westminster Cathedral, which I've already read, and I'm about at the end of this thing. I think there are probably no questions, but I'll simply say that what he is an apostle of is the quiet spirit. Love God, love his world. No, we're not going to go side happy on modern ecology. We're not going to say that one tree frog is worth 10,000 million people. We're not going to make baby seals more important than human babies. But to love God and to love his world. And in loving God and loving his world, you learn to enjoy God and enjoy the world that God has given. That's really the heart of the complete angler. And I think in particular, men of scientific demeanor need to pay some attention to that sometimes. Not everybody, because many do. But when I read Francis Crick, for example, I think he should go out and sit by the stream sometime and contemplate on nature and what man really is. What others. I don't read those fellows widely. They just come by from time to time. It's easy to develop a very hard view of the world and of life if you don't take a few moments to enjoy what God has done in your soul and what he's done in the world around you. And that's what Walton really says. And that's why I thought he'd make a nice talk for IBRI at some time. And this is the time, and that's the talk. I think we're ready to hit the refreshments. Do you think so, Dr. Newman? If there are any questions, they can always be mailed to me in Dublin, Pennsylvania.